sexploitation, blaxploitation, mockumentary, Kunaguna. That's the name of a movie genre. Bear with me here. Also blackface, stolen footage, and gorilla suits. If you watch Tor's Cabinet, there's a good chance you know a thing or two about bad movies. But even if you know a thing or two about bad movies, there's a good chance you've never heard of this one, even though it was one of the highest grossing movies of its year. Let's take a deep dive into the barrel of Berserk that is Engaji, an American movie from 1930. Thanks to my incomparable co-writer and discoverer of stories, Claire Dissot, I am obliged to talk about monkeys yet again. Although, now let's start at the beginning. When you think of gorillas in classic Hollywood, you think of King Kong. For good reason. These effects blew people's minds back in 1933, but Mr. Kong was far from the only silverback on the silver screen. In fact, there was sort of a craze for gorillas at the time. The part of Africa where gorillas live is so remote, Europeans only confirmed gorillas to exist in 1847. Because of that, gorillas were synonymous with adventure, with the most exotic reaches of the world. Imperialism was still thought of as a noble pursuit. Taming the wilderness was still a goal proudly aspired to. You want to show someone's an intrepid explorer? You have him face off against a gorilla. And if there was a gorilla in a Hollywood movie before King Kong, you could bet that under that hairy suit was a man named Charlie Gamora. The resemblance of his name to a different city-destroying big bad was a coincidence. Mr. Gamora was a prince among apes. His colleagues dubbed him King of the Gorilla Men, and it was a massive compliment. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Husalino the Capybara, and Siegfried the Slug. Thimble is off on her yacht this week, and welcome to my chair. Gorillas. What do you know about them? They're big, they're fearsome, they're surprisingly easy to hire on Fiverr to go after my enemy. Long before he was Hollywood's man in the gorilla suit, Charlie Gamora was born Carlos Cruz Gamora in 1903 on the island of Negros in the Philippines. His family was wealthy, owning oil-rich land that covered a third of the island, yet Charlie's childhood comes straight out of a Dickens novel. Upon his father's death, Charlie's eldest brother pressured the whole family, his eight siblings and their mother, into signing their shares of the land over to him. Charlie, all of 9 years old, refused. He ran away to Manila, the capital. There he lived on the streets, diving for the pennies sailors throw in the water for fun. Somehow, the eldest brother found Charlie, brought him back, and locked him up in a monastery. For 6 years, he hoped Charlie would sign the land deeds. Nope. At age 16, Charlie ran away again. This time, he embarked as a stowaway on a ship, headed to San Francisco. Soon he moved to LA. There, he was adopted by the Westmore family. If you like old movies, you may not be familiar with that name, but you've seen their work before. A lot. The father, George Westmore, would start a dynasty, 5 generations of prominent Hollywood makeup artists. All of his 6 sons would occupy executive positions in makeup and special effects at 4 major studios. But all of this was yet to happen. As teenagers, the 6 Westmore boys and Charlie Gamora would camp outside Universal Studios, hoping to be hired as extras for the day. To pass the time, Charlie would draw portraits of people as they left the studio. That's how Charlie got discovered. If he can draw, he can sculpt, someone thought. He can't sculpt, actually, but he learns fast. Soon, Charlie's putting together huge sculptures for the sets of megastars at the time. Douglas Fairbanks and Lon Chaney. As a sculptor and a budding makeup artist, Charlie designs animal suits for other actors. He starts in 1925 for films like The Lost World, where a gorilla impersonator wanders among dinosaurs. Charlie doesn't think the actors in the suits are doing a great job. They don't move like the real thing. They can't deliver emotions through the rubber mask, and who ever heard of a gorilla without emotions? At 5'4", Charlie is the perfect height to play an ape. So he designs his own gorilla suit, and it becomes like a second skin. From his first gigs, it's clear he's good at it. That's not all he does. He turns out to be a great sculptor and a superior makeup artist. But the gorilla is what pays the bills. In the late 1920s, Charlie is making $500 a week, almost $10,000 today. Again, there's real money in being the gorilla guy because gorillas are everywhere. As a gorilla, he does comedy with Laurel and Hardy and the Marx Brothers. He does horror with Bela Lugosi, drama with Lon Chaney, adventure with Robert Mitchum. His daughter Diana reckons that through hundreds of uncredited appearances, Charlie may have earned up to $1 million by that point. What do you do if you suddenly amass a fortune like that? Any financial planner will tell you, invest it into the stock market. About that. So, 1929 comes along. Charlie is ruined, but the world still needs films, and films still need gorillas, more than ever, it turns out. Around 1928, a new genre of films had begun to hit the zeitgeist. It would get to be called Guna Guna, from a word in an Indonesian language meaning evil magic, supposedly. A Guna Guna epic is a travelogue depicting semi-nude native women performing, according to Wikipedia, exotic rituals and customs.
But you can't deny the local customs.
You absolutely cannot deny the local customs.
You cannot deny the local customs.
Yeah, you might call it that. Sure, it's a very focused approach to ethnography, though. Within a few years, the Hays Code will begin to enforce good Christian morals on screen, but it's not in effect yet, and it always carried a King Kong-sized loophole. There's a lot that you're not allowed to show in fiction that you can show in a documentary. Let me give you a few titles of Guna Guna films. Wild Women of Borneo, The Virgin of Sarawak. Lagong, Dance of the Virgins. I'm starting to see a pattern here. Love Life of a Gorilla. Spoiler, it does not involve lady gorillas. White Sirens of Africa. And, inevitably, Love Island. By this point, you may be surprised to learn that the term Guna Guna has no known connection to present-day slang. Among these films, hairy and blood-curdling in the heart of Africa hides what may well be the worst film ever made. It was reported lost for a while, though it really never was. Its nitrate prints coiled in the Library of Congress film vault. It was just banned. Its name was Ingaji. Ingaji starts production in early 1930. Charlie Gamora is cast in the title role. I say title because a poster of the time tells us Ingaji means gorilla. It actually does, in Kinyarwanda, the official language of Rwanda. Charlie takes his job seriously. He studies the primates at the San Diego Zoo. He makes his own suit, painstakingly crocheting yak hairs onto canvas, three hairs at a time. He builds a mechanical jaw with teeth fashioned from toothbrush handles. Such professionalism, however, is not the mark of Ingaji director William S. Campbell. The man started working with animals when he literally ran away with a circus. Later, around 1908, he may have written the script for the first feature-length war drama ever made in the US, titled How the Cause Was Won, and about 20 minutes long. That was feature-length for 1908. It was produced by William Selig, who'll show up again later in this story. But Campbell's expertise lies in comedy shorts, and his specialty is monkeys. He finds success with a chimp called Snooky, an orangutan named Joe Martin, and a female chimp billed as Mrs. Joe Martin. In 1922, the Selma Times-Journal claims that Campbell has directed, quote, nearly all the famous monkeys that have appeared in motion pictures in the past 6 years. Not as niche a claim to fame then as it would be now. Yet Ingaji is not a comedy. Not deliberately, anyway. We follow a party of explorers, led by Sir Hubert Winstead and Captain Daniel Swain, into the heart of the Belgian Congo. Incidentally, the Belgian Congo was a remarkably awful place. It was not your average colony providing riches and slaves to a Western country at large. It was worse. It was the personal property of the King of Belgium. It was not Belgian territory, it was just the territory of one guy, King Leopold II. This made the Congo Free State, as the king named it, impervious to human rights, ethics issues, and basic, you know, laws that other countries had to wriggle their way around for appearance's sake. It allowed for a particular brand of lawless cruelty and a string of atrocities way too long for this episode. It got to the point that other colonial powers were horrified by the brutality of how Leopold, who never visited his massive African backyard, was treating the natives. In 1908, amid a global outcry, the Belgian government took control of the Congo, which made things at least a little better, but it was still a Belgian colony at the time Ngadi was made. There had been numerous expeditions by Western parties into the Belgian Congo, including one by legendary explorer Henry Morton Stanley of Dr. Livingstone fame. Under the guise of charting the territory, bringing enlightenment to the natives, or rescuing allies of Western powers, they would pilfer as much gold, rubber, and ivory as they could fit onto their porters' backs. So, anyway. The first hour of Ngadi is a safari disguised as a scientific expedition. The explorers capture a python. Yoink! They shoot crocodiles, a rhino, a couple of hippos for dinner. They narrowly escape a charging lion. They discover a tortadillo, a new species that looks like a cross between an armadillo and a turtle. We're told the creature killed one of the expedition's dogs with its venomous bite. The tortadillo is an amazing scientific discovery, most notable for its paper winglets and scales hastily glued onto its shell. After six reels of carnage, accompanied by white man's burden-esque narration, our intrepid explorers finally come upon the object of their quest. You see, this tribe worships the fearsome gorillas. So, once a year, they offer one of their women to the great apes, to appease the primate's wrath. We're told that this custom has produced human-gorilla hybrid offspring. The narrator even pretends to spot one of these children. And, what do you know? Our intrepid explorers arrive in the village on the very day this sacrifice is about to take place. The purportedly native women, in reality black American actresses from LA, are obviously walking around in the nude, otherwise, what's the point? But don't get your hopes up, they're filmed from a long way away for maybe 20 seconds total. We also come across so-called pygmies, played by Californian kids, some in blackface. The explorer tries to lure them into the open by shaking a beaded necklace at their hiding spot, seriously. For actual pygmies, check out my video on their mind-blowing polyphonic music and the American drifter who became so obsessed with the music he integrated into their culture. As for the gorillas, where are the gorillas? There's Charlie Gamora in his suit, sweating and panting in the California sun, yeah. As you could probably have guessed, none of this is actually in the Congo. He gets shot and killed by Bungalow Bill here, so he rates an actual minute of screen time. A couple more dudes in gorilla getup aren't so lucky, filmed from afar through the bushes. For close-ups, the rubber masks of the gorilla suits wouldn't have cut it, so stand-ins are picked among chimpanzees and orangutans. Yes, orangutans, which are from Indonesia, appear in this movie set in Africa, lifted from stock footage. More on that shortly. In the 80 minutes of this zoophilic pith helmet piffle calling itself gorilla in a local language, there isn't a single actual gorilla in sight. Now that the film is completed, it needs a studio to handle national distribution. In April 1930, representatives of Congo Pictures Limited are knocking on theater doors on Market Street in San Francisco, offering purchase rights to Ngadi. All the theaters recognize the documentary as a fake and turn it down. All but one. The Orpheum decides to screen Ngadi and to promote it with a vengeance. They host a jungle-themed exhibition in the lobby. In the first week, they rake in an unprecedented $23,000, almost half a million today. In one theater. RKO Studios, who own the Orpheum chain of cinemas, pick up the national rights. Soon, Ngadi is playing everywhere. Despite the dreadful photography, despite the equally dreadful ethnography, and despite, or more likely thanks to its particular brand of racist and sexist exploitation, Ngadi is a huge, huge hit. Detailed bookkeeping has been lost, but with an estimated $4 million in tickets sold nationwide and a laughably small production budget, this film ranks as one of 1930's top grossing pictures. The critics have a field day. The Houston Chronicle calls it howlingly ridiculous, so obviously fake that one forgets to resent it. The New York Times singles out the photography, complaining that the screen is a miserable blur for minutes at a time, and remarks that the gorillas are, quote, not at all convincing. Variety seems disappointed that the, quote, ape women are, seen completely naked, but shadowed in a clearing, and they are not as black as expected for the jungle. Okay. But even as they comment on the film's qualities, or abysmal lack thereof, most critics insist that the expedition is a fake, the science is a hoax, the whole thing is a sham. So now the trouble starts. Slowly at first. In June, the Ohio State Board of Censors orders the local picture distributor, a Mr. Skirol, to start every screening with a foreword explaining which parts of the film are studio made and which parts actually originated in the jungle. Soon it gets worse. The Motion Picture Producers and Distributors Association, or MPPDA, doesn't for a minute buy the premise that Ngadi is a travelogue of an actual expedition. By June of 1930, its members are ordered to cease exhibiting and distributing Ngadi. Congo Pictures Limited, the production company, strikes back. They sue the MPPDA for $3,365,000 in damages. To keep showing the movie, they transfer copies from MPPDA-affiliated theaters to independent movie houses. The next suit comes from one Byron McKenzie. He claims that large sections of Ngadi were taken from the 1915 documentary Heart of Africa, a documentary shot by his mother, big game hunter Lady Grace McKenzie. Ironically, Grace McKenzie was not adverse to a bit of a hoax herself, as a lady she never was. She didn't shoot the whole film Heart of Africa either, piecing together her own footage with bits from other documentaries and newsreels. And she tried very hard to convince the world that she was the first white woman to conduct an expedition in Africa. She was not. Mary Kingsley, who lived with tribes in West Africa in the 1890s and spoke against the British and French attempts at Christianizing Africans, preceded her by a good 20 years, and if you have an hour to spare, you should read her travel accounts. They're witty and hilarious and brave, and everything Ngadi is not. But Grace McKenzie did at least mount an actual expedition. Byron McKenzie is awarded $150,000 in damages, paid by the producers of Ngadi. In October of the same year, African-American actor Hilton Phillips is suing Congo Pictures. Phillips was purportedly hired to play an African native, then, quote, promoted to the guerrilla division, which raised his salary to $6.50 a day, a sum he claims he wasn't paid. Wait, okay, the guerrilla division? The MPPDA hires a private investigator. It doesn't take long for the sleuth to locate Charlie Gamora. Charlie signs an affidavit admitting he played the lead guerrilla. The same detective uncovers that the wildlife scenes were shot in Griffith Park Zoo, what LA residents of today would call the old zoo. Most of the wild animals displayed at Griffith Park were donated by William Selig. That's director William Campbell's old pal from the Civil War short they worked on. Griffith Park Zoo was, for all intents and purposes, Selig's private lot, a place where he could shoot his own jungle films after he'd failed to convert his own studios into an animal theme park. Now, the excellent Motion Picture Magazine, a trade weekly, runs a special on Ngadi. They interview a veteran adventure film director. Remember the scene where a bloodthirsty lion charges the expedition before the fearless hunter shoots him dead? This director tells the magazine, "I've shot that lion myself, half a dozen times. That's his trick, to be killed." That's right, in early Hollywood there lived a specific lion whose job was playing possum. The MPPDA findings prompt the Better Business Bureau to start their own investigation into Ngadi. They discover that there are no such people as Sir Hubert Winstead or Captain Daniel Swain, the movie's purported explorers. Reaching for the spotlight, the American Society of Mammalologists, who deal in mammals and not the other thing that also is prominent in Ngadi, denounces the movie. In 1933, the Federal Trade Commission issues the fatal blow, a cease and desist order against Congo Pictures, ordering them to stop representing the film as a factual record of an expedition in Africa. Technically, they ban the film outright. Look, we're not gonna feel sorry for Ngadi. No one can pretend there's anything to save from this. Even the curator of the Library of Congress Film Vault had misgivings when the German company Kino Lorber offered to do a 4K restoration as part of their Forbidden Fruit Blu-ray collection, dedicated to exploitation films passed off as documentaries. Very common in the 1930s and 40s, the experience of Ngadi being sued by everyone and their sister did not do anything to tamp down this trend. But, a bit like the film's photography, it's not all black and white in here. The regulatory powers of the time acted like we'd hope to act today, on the basis that a movie is fiction and a documentary depicts reality. Well, not so fast. It took decades for documentary filmmakers to agree on the rigorous ethics that's mostly in effect nowadays. Back in the 1920s, the first titles that film historians agree on calling feature-length documentaries, like Robert J. Flaherty's Nanook of the North about the Inuit, or Marion Cooper and Ernest Shudsack's Chang about a Thai farmer, made regular use of staging and recreations when the behaviors they wanted to document weren't forthcoming. There's a scene in Ngaji where the explorers use a gramophone to record the language of African people. That idea was lifted straight out of Nanook of the North, where Flaherty plays his gramophone for the Inuit. That's not ethnography, that's staging for effect. The Inuk playing Nanook, Inuk is the singular form of Inuit, and the guy's real name was Alakarialik, he knew what a gramophone was. He was acting. But it took decades for the documentary community to admit Flaherty's methods were less than hallowed. Ngaji entered the public domain on January 1st, 2026. You can now watch it legally on YouTube. I'm not sure I'd recommend it, but it certainly holds its place in film history. Ngaji was not the first Woman Snatched by Gorilla movie. That dubious title probably goes to Sherlock Holmes and the Great Mystery, a 1908 mishmash of Sherlock lore and Edgar Allan Poe's Murders in the Rue Morgue. The theme itself is as old as gorillas, or rather as old as when the West first got proof of their existence. That would be 1847. In 1859, sculptor Emmanuel Fremier caused great consternation at an art event for his sculpture of a massive gorilla abducting an African woman. Not because it was considered racist, don't be ridiculous, because it was considered powerfully sexual. We know that because the bronze sculpture was later exhibited behind a curtain, reserved for men and married women. Fremier would return to the subject 30 years later and replace the original victim with a white woman. The piece looks to have acquired international repute, judging by this ad for the New York screenings of Ngaji. They actually reference Fremier in here as something you'd be expected to know about and compare it to. Many, many films, before and after Ngaji, suggest that apes kidnap women in order to have sex with them. Ngaji is notorious for clearly stating that they did, and that tribes did this as a ritual, and that human-gorilla hybrid children were conceived from these encounters. Why, when Europeans first discovered gorillas, were they so intent on sexualizing them? There's a lot to unpack here. There's the idea of women being treated as sex slaves because tradition. In the Age of Empires, this was a common justification for the civilizing mission sort of colonialism. The natives treat their women like objects, and we have to save these women from their oppression. Gorillas also look so eerily human-like, it's difficult not to speculate, with biology as a new science and Darwin's theories fresh in people's minds, whether a human could conceive a child with a gorilla. Maybe not a white human, but we're still in the era when different races were considered different species. And there's the assumed terrifying superiority of the black man in the bedroom, because who do you think the gorilla stands for? You can also draw a line from the gorilla in Ngaji to less racialized monsters that also abducted women in classic movies, like, 20 years later, The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And then, much more recently, Guillermo del Toro made the subtext text with a surprisingly heartfelt love story about The Creature from the Black Lagoon in The Shape of Water. Wanting to be abducted by a monster that is fearsome at first but ultimately loving and protective is one of the timeless classic taboo female fantasies. But when Ngaji is released in 1930, we are in a segregated country. One of the many things the Hays Code specifically banned was romances between people of different races. Interracial mixing, that's the taboo Ngaji is really going for. As for real-life human-gorilla hybrids, could those exist? No. Humans and gorillas are too genetically distinct, but humans and chimpanzees may not be, even though they have a different number of chromosomes. Obviously, any attempt at actually producing one would be wildly unethical, so all we can do is speculate, but in 1970, a very strange chimp was discovered in the Congo and brought to America. Named Oliver and raised to perform at small-time amusement parks, he walked fully upright, seemed to be attracted to human women, smiled eerily, and went bald on the top of his head early in his life, none of which are usually things chimps do. He was exhibited as a missing link and attracted genuine scientific interest as a potential human-chimp hybrid, but when he died, genetic testing conclusively proved that Oliver was just a weird chimp after all. All monkey, no man. Ngaji's popular success opened the door to another decade of screen gorillas. It's not a stretch to assume that when the film banged its chest atop the box office heights, Cooper and Shudsack, the celebrated documentary filmmakers who made Chang in 1927, were circling the building. They're already in talks with RKO, the studio distributing Engaji. 3 years later, their own guerrilla flick would build on similar foundations. King Kong just had the stroke of genius to make the monkey really, really big. Yes, the two men who made the original King Kong had previously been documentarians. Well, sort of. Inadvertently, thanks to its framing device, Engaji launched a genre that's still popular today, the mockumentary. When I found that review complaining that the footage in Engaji was a, quote, miserable blur, I immediately thought of The Blair Witch Project, which, despite that, is an actually great movie. Another movie that uses that format is the 80s Italian shock fest Cannibal Holocaust, which I once saw a comment comparing my own background music to the music from this movie. It works really well in horror because the documentary pretends helps you suspend disbelief, but mockumentaries can span all genres, from a comedy masterpiece like Spinal Tap, or one of my favorite movies of all time, Best in Show, to the politically charged 60s epics by Peter Watkins. As far as we can tell, nobody had done that before Engaji. That didn't help its director, though. William Campbell only made one more motion picture after Engaji. Numapu, released in 1931, is in the running for the lowest rating ever bestowed on a film on IMDb, with a glorious 1.7 stars out of 10. Another mockumentary, it purports to document cannibalism in the Solomon Islands. Charlie Gamora is in there somewhere, doing God knows what. The film sucks so bad that it doesn't even rate an entry in the American Film Institute database. After Engaji, the guerrilla trend carried on. 1940 saw the release of the inevitable Son of Engaji. While the plot has no connection to the original, Son of Engaji is sort of a landmark in film history for being the first sci-fi horror movie to feature an all-black cast. Engaji's actual son, released into the wild without a visa back in 1937, was called Love Life of a Gorilla. Billed as a documentary once again, because why not? Sure, they went through those years of lawsuits, and I guess they'd do it again. It contained generous chunks of the original. This launched a 4-year battle with the MPPDA because some people never learn. They repeatedly asked to remove nudity and implications that African women, quote, cohabit with gorillas and produce offspring. You'd think that trend died a slow and silent death when monsters and aliens replaced gorillas as moviegoers' favorite adversaries. Not so. Found footage mockumentaries hiding under the guise of ethnological exploration in order to dish out the cheapest thrills in sex and horror, simultaneously, if at all possible, provide the foundation for the Mondo genre. Mondo movies, popular with the counterculture of the 60s and 70s, are typically feature-length compilations of short, shocking staged documentary clips of things happening across the world, across Il Mondo. The movie that started the trend was a 1962 Italian hit called Mondo Cani, literally a dog's world, but in terms of how that would sound to Italians, I'd translate it as something more like a crazy ass world. A lot of Mondo Cani would be familiar to the audiences who queued up to see Engaji. One scene features bare-breasted Polynesian women chasing after men, and another sees a New Guinean tribe slaughtering hundreds of pigs in a ritual frenzy. But it's not just exploring the global south. Mondo Cani also includes footage of geese in France being force-fed for foie gras, drunken brawls in the Hamburg red light district, a pet cemetery in California, and various strange local festivals in its own home country of Italy. Equal opportunity gawking. Mondo Cani spawned its own whole genre of staged documentaries about loosely connected weird shit, most of which had Mondo in their title, even though only some of them were Italian, and before long, cheapo American and Japanese studios were making Mondo movies too. Some had a theme, tying all the footage together. Geographical, like Mondo Hollywood, Mondo New York, or Africa, Blood and Guts. Or thematic, like Mondo Topless, or Mondo Keyhole, a not-so-sober look at the world of sex trafficking, but others were just as unfocused as the original, like Mondo Trasho, or Mondo Bizarro. The original cast of SNL even made a feature-length parody of the genre, 1979's Mr. Mike's Mondo Video. Either way, they showed that the tradition of passing off shock as ethnography was far from dead. After the Engaji debacle, Charlie Gamora continued working as usual. Apparently his signing the affidavit, effectively the first indisputable proof in the case, didn't hurt his employment opportunities at all. The world still needed movies, and the movies still needed gorillas. Charlie worked on the makeup of 58 films. He reprised his gorilla role for at least 43 more uncredited appearances that we know of, and he was always learning, trying new stuff. He worked on the world's first 3D movie in 1952, Buona Devil, the terrifying true story of the Lions of Tsavo. The Lions of Tsavo were a pair of unusually fierce lions who preyed on dozens, possibly hundreds, of human workers building a railroad in Kenya in the 1890s. Usually animals that could kill and eat a human, lions, tigers, bears, you know them, don't. Except in self-defense, mainly because they don't tend to live in environments where they often come across humans, so how to hunt a human and if it's worth eating at all doesn't cross their mind. The Tsavo lions are one of just a handful of cases where a population of apex predators discovered that humans are tasty and began deliberately hunting them to eat them. It also may have been because these particular lions had tooth infections that made it difficult to hunt their tough usual prey like wildebeests. I guess humans are the spam of wildlife. Anyway, there was a movie made about the quest to trap and kill the Tsavo lions that came out in 1952, and yes, it was the world's first 3D movie. There was a whole 3D movie craze in the 50s that's completely forgotten today. It was an early attempt to lure people back to movie theaters after it was thought that TV would make cinema obsolete. Complaints about how people no longer go out to see movies because at-home entertainment has gotten better are surprisingly old. Buona Devil had been filmed with two cameras 6 feet apart, with two rolls of film overlaid on each other, one reel tinted cyan and one tinted red, which is why those old classic 3D movie glasses handed out to the audience had one red lens and one blue lens. Every studio came out with 3D movies for a few years after Buona Devil, which were the same sort of movies that typically show in 3D today. Nature and travel documentaries, space adventures, fantasy epics, and then the craze died down for a few decades. 1950s 3D movies required an intermission for the projectionist to change reels because running two reels of film exceeded the projector's space limit for a feature-length movie. There were also experiments around then with movies you could smell, which were not as successful. And through it all, movies needed critters, and Charlie Gamora was still more than willing to put on a suit. As far as I know, he never resented playing gorillas and various other animals on screen. Charlie hadn't wanted to be an actor in the first place. He never planned to be a leading man, and besides, there were plenty of leading handsome actors. That was a dull, common dream. Far more interesting, far more unique, to be alongside every star of the time under a costume. Films were moving to greener creatures, so he built alien suits for the original War of the Worlds in 1953, and Charlie took time off to return to his native land. First, he built a chain of drive-ins and juice bars, the first of their kind in the Philippines. Before there was Jollibee, the one with two L's, there was Charlie Gamora. It was an instant hit with the American soldiers stationed on the islands. Charlie sold the drive-ins to buy a string of Filipino movie theaters. The dream he chased was to direct his own films for the Filipino audience. The theaters made that possible, so he wrote, directed, and produced. On paper, his stories weren't too different from your jungle variety apesploitation. The Gorilla and the Lady tells of a young noblewoman who is carried into the jungle by a great ape. Oh, come on, man, haven't you had enough of that? But you see, once he was left to his own devices, Charlie wasn't going for the sexual subtext and the shock value. The Gorilla and the Lady, that's a children's story. The lady in question was all of 6 years old, and the actress Charlie chose for the part was Diana, his own daughter. Charlie's career as a director was cut short by the last in a series of heart attacks. Heart attacks that may well have been brought on by his innumerable gigs in the gorilla suit. It's not all fun and bananas in there. Don't think fur coat, think 60-pound furry hazmat suit, from head to toe with no holes to let the air in. Charlie would have oxygen tanks on hand between takes. And the job hasn't changed much, if at all, in the 100 years since. Ask Rick Baker, the 9 Academy Award winner who designed, well, half the creatures you've ever seen on a screen, likelier than not. Like the apes in Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes, the spectacularly lifelike Bigfoot in Harry and the Hendersons. Baker has a career spanning everything from Star Wars to The Grinch to Gremlins to Men in Black. His first serious job, age 25, Baker designed the mechanical head for the 1976 King Kong, which, in another unexpected Tours Cabinet connection, was directed by John Gillerman, who later married Miss Martindale, the one-time leader of the Silver Sisterhood cult. Behind the scenes, the giant hydraulic ape was clunky and didn't film well, so most of the Kong you see in the film is Rick Baker in a suit he made with a silicone undersuit for realistic muscles. Well, after a few days of shooting, Baker had such a vicious headache, he went to the doctor. Turned out his eyes were so starved for air inside the suit, his contact lenses were asphyxiating his corneas. He had to have holes drilled into them. And that's just one of many unpleasant memories he keeps from this shoot. The world still needs movies. Movies, apparently, still need gorillas. and Hollywood gorillas still need a bit of sapiens to make the illusion work. Even Peter Jackson called on Andy Serkis, of Gollum fame, to do motion capture for his version of King Kong. If anyone's the modern-day Charlie Gamora, it's Andy Serkis. He's a star, you know his name, but do you know what he looks like? Probably not. You know what all the CGI monsters and stuff he plays look like. Today, a new generation of physical actors is taking over the monkey business. British actor John O'Davies did motion capture for the most what-the-fuck movie of 2024, Better Man, the biography of Robbie Williams from the 90s boy band Take That, where the pop star is played by a CGI chimp. Not only am I not making this up, I'd say the film is actually worth a try. But if horror is more your bag, there's another silver screen simian who still might be playing at a theater near you when this episode comes out. Playing the title role in Paramount's Primate is Miguel Torres Umba, a movement specialist and theater actor hailing from London by way of Colombia. He donned an actual chimpanzee suit for the part. That's not CGI, that's a guy in a really good suit. Miguel is in every shot. His chimp is adorable and smart, and he bites off people's faces. This is the kind of monkey movie I want to see. I've said before that I find monkeys and apes unsettling. They land right smack dab in the uncanny valley for me. They're too human and yet not human, but Tor, you say. Wouldn't that mean you especially don't want to see a movie about a chimp that kills people? No, I especially don't want to see a movie about a chimp that doesn't kill people, because I find it difficult to see a chimp as a good guy. Chimps give me the same frisson of fun terror that a good horror movie does. I'm glad someone else had that idea and made the movie. You may have heard around a campfire at some point, or in some Reddit thread headlined, "What's the scariest thought that ever occurred to you?" or something, the following idea. The uncanny valley effect is well studied and pretty universal. It's ingrained in us before we can even talk. Therefore, early humans must have had an evolutionary reason to fear something that looks a lot like a human, but not quite. A lot of people are one-shotted by this revelation and start to believe in prehistoric zombies or something. Peter Watt's novel Blindsight takes this idea and uses it to posit Pleistocene humans living alongside a race of vampires that preyed on them, and despite that, it's a hard sci-fi novel that really thinks through its conception of vampires. Highly recommend if you're into really dense, really intense sci-fi. But that thought has never been too scary to me. It's just made me go, well, duh. Yes, of course early humans had an evolutionary reason to fear something that looks a lot like a human, but not quite. Yes, it makes total sense that the evolutionary origin of the Uncanny Valley comes from early humans having to compete with other members of the great ape family for the same habitat. Chimpanzees today engage in organized warfare against other tribes of chimps. What's to say, far back when we were still dragging our knuckles on the ground, chimps and humans didn't fight each other? The Uncanny Valley isn't about being scared of something that looks like a corpse. As psychologists often claim, I think it's about being scared of something that looks like a chimp. Or maybe not chimps. My actual theory is that the Uncanny Valley comes from more recent battles we've fought against other hominid species. For thousands of years, we lived alongside species that looked even more like humans, but not quite. Neanderthals in Europe and Denisovans in Asia, both of whom definitely competed with Homo sapiens for the same habitats and may have been victims of genocide purposely carried out by Homo sapiens. I can't find research on whether the Uncanny Valley effect is stronger in people from Eurasia than elsewhere, but my hypothesis is that it would be. It's not common to feel Uncanny Valley about all great apes the way I do, but also not unheard of. I've met other people who agree with me. I think for whatever reason, I'm just still running the same old Savannah software. I was born in the wrong generation. Put me in 300,000 BCE, I could have brought glory to the tribe by fending off so many fucking chimps. I'm not too weird. Not in this way, at least. The fact that the movie Primate is so successful right now means other people must understand the inherent creepiness of a chimp. You know how monkeys were so popular in the early 20th century? Same as how clowns were? And now we've come to see clowns as creepy, uncanny villains in horror movies. I think we're seeing that change right now with monkeys. Miguel Torres Umba, the man in that suit, steals the show, scary as any monkey put on film ever was. But Miguel didn't have to design his own suit, and he gets full credit for the performance. The days of the uncredited apes are over. The time has come for other apes, like you and I, to tell their stories.